Welcome to In the Frame, an exciting new podcast series where we're delighted to be touring the UK, meeting business leaders, and taking a look at the big picture of what makes businesses tick. I'm Paul Kempster.
And I'm Andrea DeLay. And together we co-head the mid-corporate business for Barclays, as well as being co-hosts for this podcast series.
Well, I'm delighted to be in the vibrant Gateshead today with Sarah Venning, who is the Director of Finance and People at the Glasshouse International Centre for Music. I'm also pleased to be joined by my colleague Peter Kirkpatrick, who is the Relationship Director for Barclays Corporate locally in Newcastle. Now, Sarah, we met earlier this year and it's wonderful to see you again. And perhaps you could start by telling us the big picture of your business here.
Thank you for having me on the podcast. It's really good to be here. So the Glasshouse International Centre for Music is a charity which runs based in the northeast of England, as you know, and it's run as a charity for music lovers of all sorts. So we run everything from children's education classes all the way from babies right through to adult education, activities, bands, choirs. We have two main halls. So Sage 1 is the big hall. Sage 2 is the smaller venue. And we have a range of performers there from emerging artists all the way through to top acts. We're home for the Royal Northern Sinfonia, which is our resident orchestra, who tour both around the region, nationally and internationally, and obviously perform in the venue. And we also have a commercial income offering as well. So we run conferences and events in the building and obviously run food and beverage and the bars for the performances. So there's a range of activity goes on.
There's a huge amount going on there, isn't there? And you mentioned the orchestra. Maybe just tell us a little bit more about the orchestra.
So the Northern Sinfonia, as was an orchestra in the Northeast made up from local musicians. And when the charity was set up, the Northern Sinfonia joined as part of the venture, and now they are known as the Royal Northern Sinfonia, and they're very proud to be part of the operation.
I bet they are. And I mean, for those that haven't been to the buildings here, it's an incredible venue, isn't it? And
yeah.
I'm sure they're delighted to call it home.
Yes, absolutely.
Good. Well, we're going to be talking a little bit about regional brand identity and the Glasshouse and how that brand projects itself really within the region and beyond. And I guess probably to start things off, how the Glasshouse being so well known in the Northeast, what would you say is the positive impact it's had on people within the region?
So, I mean, obviously, we have a strong audience of people who thoroughly enjoy coming to the venue to enjoy all the different things that go on. We've seen people start off their music careers here as children and are now studying either down in London or playing in other orchestras across the country, really. So we think we've contributed around $500 million to the economy in the region since the building opened in 2004. And when you look at the creative sector stats across the UK, so in 2019, it's estimated that the creative sector contributed over $100 billion to the UK economy, which is significant, and employed around 2.3 million people. So that's about 7% of the total workforce. We work really closely with the other cultural venues across the Northeast. So you've got places like the Theatre Royal, the Baltic, Tyne and Wear Archive and Museums. And between us all, we think we contribute around 94 million to the local economy. So they're big numbers. We estimate that we've had 4 million cultural attendances in a population size of about 500,000 people. So you do get, you know, we get a lot of visitors coming in from other places as well. So yeah, quite a significant impact, really.
I mean, that's amazing, actually. I didn't know those numbers myself until you just said that. And they're really quite mind-blowing to hear them, you know, not just in terms of the level of employment, but, you know, the economic value that this is bringing to the region, I guess.
Yes,
to your point.
Absolutely.
Beyond the cultural arena, it's going to be hospitality and leisure and all of those adjacent industries, I guess.
Yes. And one thing we're working on at the moment is around sort of the tech industry side of things. So where you've got people actually physically putting the shows on, doing the lighting, doing the sound, doing all that sort of thing, working on collaboration across the other venues in the area to really try and develop a tech academy, because we have more of a shortfall in the Northeast around tech resource than other parts of the country. So say down in Manchester, there's a huge sector of tech people down there, whereas we might have to bring people up to the region to help us out. So we're really trying to sort of work with other venues to drive that academic development and create career paths for people as well.
That's fascinating. I think I just wanted to come back, if I could, to the level of kind of participation that you've had from within the region, from residents within the Northeast. But you also inferred that there's a lot of demand coming from outside of the region, attracted in. So audiences coming to this area to participate. And potentially, I guess, you're reaching out of your region with technology, with live streaming. Yes. Maybe just bring to life a little bit around how that's worked for you as a strategy.
Yeah, so we in our region will consider all the way up the coast towards Alnwick and north of there, across to Cumbria, down to Middlesbrough. So not just sort of the Tyne and Wear region, but it's much bigger than that. And as an example, the orchestra goes and tours around. So they're playing in Durham tonight, and then they're playing in Hexham and Middlesbrough and various other venues across the area. So trying to take music to people. And we also get lots of people coming to visit who come to the Northeast. And as part of their weekend in the Northeast, part of it will be coming to the Glasshouse as well for a musical evening.
Peter, if I may, I was just going to bring you in just from your perspective, because listening to Sarah and listening about the importance really of a cultural magnet almost to bring people into the region, I'm sure that's probably important for your other clients that are looking to attract talent into the region to come and move to the Northeast to work. How do you see the cultural importance of venues like the Glasshouse?
I think it all adds to the overall magnetism or the draw of the local area, really, because Newcastle comes across and Gateshead as a very progressive place to work and live. It gets very good reviews. People who work and live here seem to enjoy it thoroughly. So I think trying to attract people to the Northeast, I think it can only help to showcase what we've got up here, to be fair, because there are other cities to compete against, aren't there? So yeah, having things like that definitely can add.
Yeah, and I think that's really well said. And we've actually at Barclays, we've commissioned a survey with the FT that's been looking at UK-based, regionally-based businesses where the core and the heart of their business is in the region that they're domiciled in. But actually, what we found from the survey is many UK businesses, regardless of the region that they're in, are trying to explore growth. And they're thinking about how can they grow, and particularly prioritising spreading their product, their service, their proposition into other regions of the UK to access that growth without losing their cultural identity of their home region. So it's really interesting to hear yourself and Sarah talk about some of those aspects here in the Northeast. Mm. Sarah, if I may come back to you, any business needs to keep itself fresh and relevant to be successful for the future and sustainable. And I know that this year has been a pivotal year for your business because you've gone through a very big rebranding and a renaming exercise.
We have.
You have.
And
it would be remiss of me not to talk to you about that. So I'm really interested to hear a little bit more about that from your perspective on the management team. The considerations really that you had as a management team going into that very big decision after 20 years, the sorts of things that you took into account to make sure that it would be a success when it was finally revealed to the world at large. And the reason I kind of ask that and interested in your insights is, you know, many other businesses around the UK might be listening to this and they'll think themselves about how do they position themselves? How do they brand themselves? And businesses will go through similar decision-making processes. So maybe tell us a bit about that if you would.
Yeah, so we started on the rebranding and renaming journey probably about 2 years ago now. And it took a little bit longer than we originally thought. So I think we're quite optimistic on our time frame. But we appointed an agency to help us with the journey because we recognised, you know, what a big journey it is and how important it is to get it as right as you possibly can. And we did an awful lot of consultation. So we spent quite a bit of time with the staff within the organisation, talking to them about their memories and their highlights of working here. Some of them have been here since the beginning in 2004. So there's a huge amount of material came out of that. Also, we consulted with audiences. So we had opportunities for people to put names forward and also to bring to life what the place means to them. So there was lots of reflection and memories and, you know, people's weddings, because we've done weddings here and things like that. And we took all of that input into the process of trying to identify the name. We came up with a shortlist. We had a group of the board who helped us with the journey. So they sort of led us through all of the key decisions. There was obviously legal considerations to take into account and trademarking and all that kind of thing. And we came down to a shortlist of three and then decided on the name of the Glasshouse. And really, it means quite a lot to us. So our strapline now is music lives and grows here. And I think that really reflects what we do. We start off and try and nurture talent from whatever age and whatever standard and take people as far as they want to go on their musical journey. So the concept of a Glasshouse where things grow and nurture and live was very relevant. This site was also the former Glassworks, so there's a tie back to that as well. So that was helpful. And it was a name that seemed to resonate with people, so quite a few people suggested it organically to us as well as part of the process. So that's where we ended up.
hearing that it's taken a bit longer than you had imagined to begin with, but hearing the reasons why, I think, is the most powerful kind of top tip. Almost is take your time, I suppose. Yes. You're saying to other businesses.
Yeah, yeah.
And words are important, aren't they? Mm-hmm. Because they create emotion. They create an imagery, I suppose. And having that provenance is really important, isn't it, for the future of the business?
Yeah, yeah. And it gives us an opportunity to inject a new vibrancy, I think, to the building, to the name, to the experience. So when you look around the venue now, you'll see lots of bright colour and vibrancy in the way we describe programmes. So we've changed tone of voice around how we communicate to customers and how we describe, you know, a classical program that could be quite dry in some venues. And we try and really bring it to life. So we use a lot of lively vocabulary and potentially regional in terms of spirit, but not necessarily in terms of words.
Well, I have to say, having met you a few months ago before the big reveal and now being back here today, it really does hit you very much in a very positive way. It's very vibrant. So congratulations on what you've achieved there. That's great. So, Peter, if I may turn to you, actually, because it's very interesting to hear Sarah's story there of the rebranding, the considerations that went into it. And really that lesson of, you know, taking time and care to really understand what the customers, the clients would really want to feel from a brand in the future. Now, you look after many other clients in different industries in the Northeast. What's your general experience and reflection on management teams when they come to the consideration of rebranding or not, as the case may be? Too fast, too slow, put it off?
Yeah, well,
what do you find?
I guess the proof of the pudding's in the eating, isn't it? It's a very difficult consideration for management, isn't it? Because, you know, it's a big, big decision to change the branding here, and feedback from, you know, my initial reaction and other people is the branding here has been really good and it fits with what you do. Other customers looking at branding, I mean, I've got a few customers who've got some very long established brands, and their kind of drive is to build on that and maintain that brand. So they invest in it, whether it's social media or product, in terms of making sure their product lives up to the brand. So it's a pretty difficult decision, I have to say. And I'd say the Glass House have done a great job. So long may it continue. But it's not easy, I think, is the answer.
No, thanks, Peter. It's great insight. And I'll probably come back to you in a moment or two, actually. So I'd just be interested to know about how other clients export their brand but stay in their own regions, if that makes sense. But before I do that, Sarah, I'm going to come to you and just talk to you a little bit, or ask you, if I may, about how the Glass House has gone about attracting new audiences over the years, maybe in the months, because I'm guessing you have to keep replenishing your audiences, don't you?
Yes.
And you've got to keep thinking about new things to attract new audiences. Now, whether that's within region or beyond the regional boundaries, maybe just sort of talk to us a little bit about some of the initiatives that you've undertaken.
So we have an active strategy to acquire new audiences, to develop audiences. It's part of what the Arts Council obviously want all the venues in the country to do from a cultural point of view. And also for us in the Northeast, it's really important to us that we see, you know, the next generation coming through to enjoy music in the way that the older generations have already. So if we looked at the demographic on a classical audience, as an example, that's generally an older audience. And so we're doing quite a lot of work in that area to drive new footfall into the classical space. We have put on shows like Star Wars. James Bond is coming up, I think, soon. Obviously, things like Home Alone tend to attract quite a lot of people. And it's really nice to see, I think, on the Star Wars event that we did, something like 30% of them were new to the building and 50% had never been to a classical concert before.
Wow.
So it's a real success in terms of driving just a new experience for people. You know, we do a staff event usually in September. And if you take new staff members into that event, just in Sage One, it's just friends and family, it's just nice and relaxed. And the number who've never been to a classical orchestra performance and are literally blown away when they come out, it's just lovely to see. We do things like you can, if you're 18 to 35, I think it is, you can come to a classical concert for a fiver and get a beer while you're here. So that's quite a good one. And yeah, so we do lots of initiatives to drive new audiences into different experiences.
That sounds absolutely amazing and slightly depressing for me because I don't qualify for the 18 to 35 event and a beer. But there we are. That's my own problem. Okay.
What's the big picture for your business in 2024? Our industry and regional leaders take a bird's eye view on the challenges and opportunities businesses might expect to face in the coming year. With rising costs, fraud and AI hot on the agenda, what's in store for 2024? Go to barclayscorporate.com and search Outlook 2024 to find out more.
I guess there's two other questions I've got in my mind, both technology related, actually. And I'd be interested to know how the Glasshouse has used or has been thinking of using technology to broaden the audience beyond the region, but also with that aspect, of course, of the pandemic, which we can't and shouldn't forget. You know, it's a major time in society and for businesses, not least arts-based businesses
that
were very heavily impacted, as we know. So what sort of use of technology to reach new audiences, either during that period or beyond, have you been deploying?
So I think in the pandemic was the first time that we really deployed digital streaming. And I joined early into the pandemic. And what I heard as I joined was, this is quite difficult and we've not done this before. So it was a real learning curve. And since then, we've then developed our digital ability and digital team. We've invested in that quite heavily. And we currently live stream concerts out to audiences free of charge for 30 days. We get audiences, you know, joining from all over the world, and you'll see them on the chat when performances are going on. You'll see comments from checking in from such and such a place, Australia or Denver or wherever, which is really nice to know that you've got an international audience.
It's like a real barometer, live barometer, isn't it? Of your audience reach. That's incredible. Yeah.
And I think it's a real opportunity for everybody with friends and family or connections back to the Northeast. You'll find that a lot of people who've grown up here and then moved away like to connect back as well. So it gives them a way of staying in touch with things that are close to them and familiar. The orchestra tours internationally, which is fabulous. They've just been to South Korea last year, hoping to tour again next year. So that's physically touring not only around our region, but also nationally and internationally, which is important. But I think having the digital technology to be able to share all sorts of events, stream on Radio 3 with proms and that kind of thing. So there's all sorts of stuff going on, which is reliant on that digital ability.
For me to think about a music-based arts business, which I guess by history would be very traditionally physically a venue that you would hear, embracing technology really to reach the same or new audiences globally is incredible, actually, and spread that brand beyond the Northeast boundaries.
Yes.
It's amazing.
Yeah. And it's very much part of our strategy. It's something we take really seriously and invest in. So it's good to see it growing.
Right.
Yeah.
And Peter, when you think again about your broader client base in the Northeast and listening to Sarah there around the success the Glasshouse has had by embracing technology, albeit maybe no one's expecting to have to do that, but, you know, it happened and now it's turning into kind of commercial reach and success. Have you seen similar themes with other industries in the Northeast that have embraced that technology to reach new audiences, new client bases across the UK to grow?
Yes, Paulie. I've got a few professional services firms, and they are very strong in the Northeast, got a very good reputation. But then obviously they want to expand, and to do that, they want to expand across the country. And that really, they have embraced technology in terms of understanding what they're very good at. So they've got a niche in a certain area and then want to pick off areas of the country where they feel there's growth opportunities, but they need to get the message out. And therefore they use technology in trying to make interesting articles, use LinkedIn, use other mediums to try and get that message across, because they don't want to be scattergunned, but they really need to build on what they're good at and trying to be very focused on that. So yeah, I've seen that. It's not easy because there's a lot out there, isn't there, in terms of messages in the market. So trying to be different and trying to make something that gets your interest. But it's a bit of a journey sometimes, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it is really interesting, isn't it, to see how UK regionally based businesses, where they've got a real identity and brand value and heritage in a geography, are now expanding into other regions without losing the heart of what their brand is and where they are. That's incredible. It's really good to see. So Sarah, I did want to ask, casting your mind back a couple of years, I guess, to the pandemic period, which of course was a hugely trying time for everyone in society. And there was a big, big impact, I know, in arts-based businesses. And I'm sure that would have been a challenging time for you and the management team to navigate. Really interested to get your insights when you reflect back about how you did safely navigate the pandemic and come out the other side into the successful business again that the Glasshouse is today. And any kind of top tips really on reflection that you would give management teams that face adversity?
Yeah, it was certainly an interesting time for everybody. But in the arena in which we work, clearly, we were shut down very quickly in the March. I mean, literally once it was all announced, the building closed. We sent all the teams home to work from home. So the IT department, I have to say, were phenomenal in setting everybody up with teams and deciding whether to use Zoom or Teams and all that kind of thing. and operate, you know, the organization, because it is quite complex with everybody working at home, was quite difficult. But they managed that very successfully. Clearly, from an audience point of view, everything just stopped. So all of the lessons and the classes and things that really mean a lot to people. I certainly remember members of my own family who are in choirs and things, and literally they had nothing to do. And it was suddenly that sort of cessation of all the things that they live for, just out of nowhere, they couldn't do it anymore. So we very quickly set up an online provision, and we moved a lot of the music lessons online so that people could join in from their homes and be safe. And obviously we secured the building. From a funding point of view, if I put the finance hat on for a moment, clearly we take about 60% of our income to support the charity is through box office and ticket sales. So that all came to an abrupt halt. We launched an appeal campaign, a renaissance and recovery campaign, which was well supported by individuals, businesses across the region. I think Barclays contributed to that as well, very kindly. And subsequently, the government and the Arts Council did step in to help organisations such as ourselves. So we did get a recovery loan, and we also got a significant grant to help us through the pandemic period. But I would say that it's taken a while to recover. So it takes a while for audiences to come back, and it takes a while to build back to normal. Even just the touring pipeline in the UK. So the amount of bands that are actually touring around when we moved out of the pandemic into the cost of living crisis and the fuel energy price crisis and everything else, meant that the product pipeline is actually less than it was pre-pandemic. So building a business back is complicated and in ways that you wouldn't necessarily anticipate at the outset. I suppose in terms of things that I would look back on and think that was a, you know, useful thing to do in that situation, we very much focused on what we knew and didn't spend too much energy trying to predict all the things that we didn't know and trying to anticipate what might go wrong. We dealt with what was more or less in front of us at the time and then moved on to the next thing from there. So I think that stopped the sense of overwhelm that is easy to get in that situation.
Thank you for sharing that with us. What I'm hearing there is focus on the inner circle almost, because otherwise you become distracted and waste time and energy on things you just cannot control. And also the importance of clear and fast communication, I guess, to colleagues, to consumers, yeah. You know, so they understand what you know and what the current plan is, rather than leaving people in limbo. Yes. That's really important. Thank you. And Peter, during the pandemic, you had a range of clients across a range of industries in the Northeast that will have had sometimes similar, but maybe different challenges, depending on the nature of their industry, whether they had to shut the doors or if they could continue trading online or whatever the case may be. But your reflections when you look back, what did you see from management teams generally? Do you think that they responded well and asked for help, or would there be any lessons learned that you would share for the future?
I mean, what I would say is, thankfully, the customers that I look after all performed really well, I would say, which is great, because it was, you know, such an unknown event at the time. Yeah, you know, some firms, I think the word pivot, I guess, isn't it, managed to change tack quickly. Technology was great, managed to help a lot of customers, you know, make staff work from home. So that all worked really well. Some customers, unfortunately, had to make redundancies. And my experience, they did that quite quickly, which was a good decision. You know, it's a shame for that people lose jobs, but thankfully they took the hard decisions. I did have some customers who, during the pandemic, you know, outdoor sports type related businesses saw a boom, which was great. So it was a challenge for them to cope with the demand. So all in all, you know, I think generally it worked very well. What I've seen since then is some customers where they saw a boom, now there's been a bit of a dip, and trying to manage that has been quite difficult, trying to predict that demand where you've been so busy and now suddenly it's tailed off a bit. So I guess management, in my experience, performed well, but there's a lot of challenges still out there.
Yeah, and I would agree with that from the teams and the businesses that I meet going around the UK. I think for me that the most important lesson that came out of that very challenging period is the need for a plan B and even a plan C. You can have the general thematics there, just be ready for things to change in your industry, in your business, or in the economy. And then you're going to have a reasonable chance, aren't you, of navigating it, I think is the key point. Good stuff. So we've found out a lot today about the Glasshouse and the business that you work in. I just really wanted to turn to finding out a bit more about you, if I may. So Sarah, I'd be really interested to know what advice you would give your younger self.
That's quite a hard question to answer, especially when you get to my age and you look back and see how much there is to think about. I suppose one thing I would say is time just flies so fast and you never think about it when you're younger. So if I think of me in my 20s, I'd never was looking ahead to me in my not 20s. So yeah, I would probably say find your tribe, find your people that you really resonate with. I've worked in various situations with different groups of people. Finding the people that you really, really like working with is so valuable because you spend so much of your time at work. It's really nice to be in a place where you can bounce off the people that you work with. Work in sectors that interest you. Again, that's another one that over time, I think you develop more of a confidence to be able to think about what you really want to do. And the other thing I think is really useful is having a mentor. So at different points, not all the time, but at different points in my career, I've had people who would spend the time from a senior point of view to sort of just be someone that you can talk to and bounce things off and get their view on things, which their experience can be really, really helpful.
I think that's really interesting advice. And I think that will resonate with a number of people listening. I'm also pleased that listening to that, you skillfully talked about being in your 20s and not being in your 20s now. And I sense that you'll be with me now that you don't qualify either for the 18 to 35 beer offer here at the Glass House. But there we are. We're together now. That's good. So, Sarah, if you were starting out again on your professional life, your career journey, what would be your dream job?
So I always wanted to do psychology, but that's kind of developed over years. And I think it's from years and years of working with different people. So I really, it's a very work-related answer, but it's something that I've always wanted to do. I really enjoy seeing teams develop and perform well. And when you look at what it is that goes into making that happen, it's sometimes really hard to sort of pin down, you know, what's that magic thing that makes a team believe in itself and make it perform. And when I was choosing my A-levels, I didn't choose psychology. And then looking back, I've always thought, why didn't you do that? Because I think sort of business psychology and performing, you know, high performing teams and all that sort of thing. One thing I do like to do is try and listen to really interesting people. And my son's school, they're running sessions for the kids around getting inspirational speakers in, you know, positive psychology and all that sort of thing. Sarah Davies was absolutely fascinating. So to listen to her and her journey, it was really, really interesting. And I think to be able to bring that to life for people would be good. So not swimming with dolphins or being an airline pilot, but no, just psychology would have been good.
That sounds great to me. That sounds really good. And if you were to think about the biggest opportunity, looking back, that you've taken, that decision you made, what would that be?
So back in 2007, I was at Northern Rock and I'd been there for quite some years. I'm sure many listeners will remember the Northern Rock story. And post the collapse of the bank, we split the bank into two parts. We had 80% of the bank went to the government into a sort of mortgage book and 20% of it formed a new bank. And I had a choice whether to go with the government side of it or into the new bank. And I chose to go in the new bank, which was riskier because that needed to be sold. And it was the best decision I ever made. It led me to where I am now. So moving into Virgin Money as they acquired the bank, then moved into the not-for-profit sector, and then ended up here at the Glass House in this job now. And it sort of brings together everything I want to do. So sort of revolving doors moment, which way do you go? And it worked out well.
That's really good to hear. That's really good to hear. Well, look, thank you, Sarah, for your time today and your insight. It's been absolutely fascinating to hear all about the Glass House, the journey of the Glass House, the regional strength of the culture, but also how that sort of emits beyond the region as well, right across the UK and the globe. So huge well done and congratulations to you and the team for that. And thank you also, Peter, for joining us today. It's been really good to get your insight across the other clients that you look after as well. Thank
Pleasure
you.
To be here. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thanks for listening. And don't forget to follow us to receive notifications of new episodes as they go live. For more insights or to find out how we can support your business, go to barclayscorporate.com. Copyright Barclays Corporate Banking, all rights reserved. Terms and conditions available at barclayscorporate.com.